CDR would like to thank the sponsor of this podcast, Saab, a longtime supporter of CDR's journalism. Saab is a leading defense and security company with an enduring mission to help nations keep their people and society safe. Empowered by more than 23,000 talented employees, Saab constantly pushes the boundaries of technology to create a safer, more sustainable, and equitable world. Saab designs, manufactures, and maintains advanced systems in aeronautics, weapons, command and control, and sensors in underwater systems, including submarines. Saab submarines are based on generations of evolutionary design that has led to the delivery of 7 submarine classes across 3 continents. Through a philosophy of modular design, Saab submarines offer a flexible approach to meeting the various operational, technical, and in-service support needs of its partner navies. Saab's Canadian operations have been supporting Canada for over 35 years, with a long-standing commitment to the Royal Canadian Navy through the provision and support of systems such as the surveillance radars and fire control systems on board the Halifax-class frigates. Saab has major operations all over the world and contributes to the domestic defense capability of several nations.
Welcome to Canadian Defense Focus from CDR Radio, produced by Canadian Defense Review Magazine. This series of podcasts features interviews with leaders and experts in the defense industry, as well as reports and profiles on the very latest in defense technology.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to CDR Radio. My name is Jody Atariwala, and I'm the senior staff writer, aviation editor, and naval specialist for the magazine. And for today's chat, I am very happy to welcome Vice Admiral Angus Topshe, the commander of the Royal Canadian Navy. Admiral Topshe, thank you so much for joining me today. It's great to have you on the program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. It's always great to talk about what's up with the Royal Canadian Navy.
Yeah. I always enjoy it as well, sir. So the Canadian Armed Forces has a new Chief of Defense Staff, General Carignan. Have you received any guidance or direction from her yet?
We've had one of the first meetings of the senior leadership of the Canadian Armed Forces. And so far, we know we're going to get together to do basically a strategic retreat in September. And I've already been given homework of 2 books to read and a movie to watch. So I'm excited about that. I think she's hit exactly the right tone in the speech she gave at the War Museum, and I'm excited to see where we go under her leadership.
Yeah, no, I am as well, Admiral. I think it'll be good, and I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, how the Canadian Armed Forces evolves under her command. So, you know, she had made comments in her speech that Canada has 5 years to prepare for emerging threats. I'm paraphrasing, but I think that's the gist of what she said there. She's not new to the Canadian Armed Forces. 5 years, if we consider how procurement has traditionally been in Canada, do you think that that's enough time to prepare for emerging threats?
No, I think it's one of the challenges we face right now is trying to figure out what is the timeline we're all working on. You know, Australia until recently had what they viewed as a 10-year horizon to prepare for strategic threats. And with their national defense strategy update recently, they threw that timeline out and said, we need to be ready now. So I think General Carignan's 5-year timeline is as good as anything we're going to get. I think we have to recognize the reality that our current procurement setup means that we are looking at 15 to 20 years before we deliver a full spectrum of capability in any project that we do. But I think we can do better than that. And I think it's not so much about the big picture things that we do, but what are all the little things we need to do to make sure that we're as ready as we can be with what we have now.
That's a very fair statement. And I love that context with Australia, because, you know, there seems to be a lot of parallels with what happens down there and Canada. Now, having said that, obviously they're off on their own. But so I think it's safe to say that the Navy is undergoing a period of stress while also undergoing a massive transformation to new classes of warships. All of that is underpinned by sailors serving in the Navy. So I think it's important to focus on that. You know, you have been very clear that the Navy is challenged when it comes to personnel. How is the Navy doing in that context now?
We are challenged by personnel. I'm quite comfortable describing it as a personnel crisis at the moment, because we are 20% short in the trained effective strength. That's the sailors that we need to do the jobs for the Navy. We're working hard to recruit and attract new Canadians into the Navy, and we're revamping the training system so that as we bring those in the door, we can get them trained to be effective and contribute as quickly as possible. But nothing's going to change the fact that it takes 5 to 10 years to build 5 to 10 years of experience of naval operations, and that the sea is always a dangerous environment. So we are going to be dealing with this for a period of time. But you're also right that it is, you know, the future is bright for the Royal Canadian Navy in the sense that we are just about to take delivery of the 5th of the Arctic and offshore patrol vessels, the Harry DeWolf class, and those have been absolutely fantastic, deploying around the world, doing great things for Canada. That we will be launching and naming the future HMCS Protector and likely in November in Vancouver, so that'll be putting us back on a path to having a proper replenishment capability designed to go to the forward edge of battle. And then the Canadian Surface Combatant, the River Class destroyers, we've started the production process with the production test module back in June. I'm excited to see what we're building with that ship. And while, of course, I always want it to come faster, the reality is at least now we have actually started the physical work of producing that ship.
Right. So there's a lot of things that we'll touch on there, Admiral. But a comment that you have made previously is that the Canadian Forces Recruitment Group has not provided you with the sailors that you need or the numbers of sailors that you need. Has that critique of them, to your knowledge, improved their processes or improved the intake of sailors for the Navy yet?
So, I mean, I think the first thing I want to note is that we have a lot of great people in the Canadian Armed Forces, and the people in the Military Personnel Generation Group and the Canadian Forces Recruiting Group are killing themselves trying to deliver the sailors, aviators, soldiers, and operators that we need into the Canadian Armed Forces. But there are a whole series of systemic and process-related problems that have been impeding their path. Mm-hmm. On the positive side, the Associate Deputy Minister has convened a recruiting campaign board that is a very high-level executive body with decision-making authority designed to create rapid and effective change across all elements of the recruiting enterprise. And the initial indications are positive that we are attracting more Canadians than ever and that we are beginning to see evidence that we're able to process them, not as fast as I want to and not as many as I might want to, but we are presently on track to hit our targets. So there are some positive indicators there, but that's only the beginning of the problem. Just getting the people in the door, like I said, is the necessary precondition to solving our personnel crisis. The next step is really making sure that we get those people through the training system as quickly as possible. And that's really where my focus is now.
Right. And is the Navy up to that challenge?
Absolutely. I've told the Navy that we need to adopt an operational mindset and put ourselves on the same sort of mobilization footing that we did in the Second World War when we grew from 5,000 sailors to 100,000 over the course of the Second World War. So I don't foresee us growing to 100,000, but I certainly do see us growing with the pace and scale there. And I think the other thing we need to recognize is that inevitably in society and the Canadian Armed Forces as a whole, we have tended to bring the level of decision-making authority and reduce the sort of power of individuals to higher and higher, bringing up to higher and higher levels, pushing that authority, pushing initiative back down. I was talking to, it was General Ayer, actually, his retirement ceremony. He talked about the fact when he was an Army second lieutenant, so equivalent to an acting sub-lieutenant in the Navy, he was teaching recruits at basic military training with a sergeant. I don't see today why we couldn't be pushing that level of leadership and responsibility back down. And right now, to be honest, it's actually held at a higher level than that. So we need to go back to where we were before. We've got petty officers for a reason. They need to be doing petty officer things and leading. Our junior officers need to be empowered to make differences. They know what right looks like. They should be training the next generation of people. And we should be, a lot of the stuff that we've tended to bring up to higher levels, we need to push that back down and make sure that the lieutenant commanders, the chiefs, the commanders are all focused on the systemic issues rather than on the day to day.
I think that's a wonderful strategy, and I'm sure it will bear fruit, Admiral. So excellent plan. So you also instituted the Naval Experience Program. Let's talk about that, because I'd love to know how that is going. And I think we are now past 1 year. And so the people that signed up for the Naval Experience Program, and certainly you can explain it better, but signed up for 1 year. And then the hope is that they like enough of what they saw that they would stay in. How is that going?
So it's been a tremendous success for us so far. We've recruited over 200 people in through the program this year. I think for the 1 year mark, our target had been 144 and we achieved 160. Like I said, we're now over 200. We are reaching the point where people have the option to decide whether or not they want to continue serving. And the initial indicators are positive. We're seeing quite a few people who have decided to make a career of the Canadian Armed Forces and are signing up for full-time service in the Navy, and in some cases in the Army or the Air Force. And in some cases, they're going into the reserves. And I think we've validated our value proposition was join the Navy. You know, well, it's fully paid. Rations and quarters, room and board are included. There's leave. It's an opportunity to experience everything that the Royal Canadian Navy has to offer. And the testimonials that you can see online, I think, really are demonstrating just how attractive that can be. The caution I offer is that, you know, it's a small sample size at this point. And so I am not really getting caught up in any of the statistics, because two people, you know, make a decision to leave or two people make a decision to stay, and you can really skew the percentages for how it goes. And so this is a 5-year pilot project. I think by this time next year, we'll have our first really solid indication of what are we seeing. My target remains 80% of the people who enroll in the Naval Experience Program remain in the Navy full time. And we are in the vicinity of that, though, like I say, it's not a statistically significant sample yet. So it can jump all over the map at this point.
Let's hope that things go well. It seems like their trajectory is on the right track, which is lovely to hear. And you mentioned that the opportunity, and I wasn't aware of this, but the opportunity is that people could join in the Army or go to the Air Force or to the reserves if they chose to. Has the other branches of the Canadian Armed Forces asked you for that Naval Experience Program formula? Like, is it something that they could emulate?
I mean, each of the services have different needs and requirements. Our challenge in the Navy is that what we do is out of sight, out of mind, and not well understood by anyone who isn't in the Navy. And so for us, the driving factor behind the Naval Experience Program was to get people into the naval environment so they could understand what all of the different occupations and opportunities are within the Navy. Just because of the way society works and the predominance of Hollywood and everything else, everybody knows what a soldier does, what someone in the Armored Corps does, you know, the artillery. These are all intuitive, easily understood things. And so I don't think the Army has ever had the same challenge of trying to get people to understand what the lifestyle is. And there's always people who are attracted to that. And then for the Air Force, they're much more focused on technicians at this point and pilots. And those are demographics that they're looking to attract in a different way. So we're certainly open. And that's why we encourage people. You know, you come in through the Naval Experience Program, you're going to do the same basic military qualification course that everyone does when they first join the Canadian Armed Forces. And if you decide the Navy's not for you, that counts for the Air Force and for the Army. And you've had the chance to figure out, does this military lifestyle work for me? And is it just a case of, you know, the Navy's not the right fit? Because it's, you know, like I said, it's a difficult life. It's not for everyone. It takes a special kind of person to be in the Navy. And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for those special Canadians who are determined to serve their country in the Navy.
Well, you know, living in Victoria, I have seen many Navy personnel over the years. And I can say for those listening, it's an awesome career. I did not join, but most of my friends are in the Navy. So if people want to pull the trigger on joining the military, try the Navy. There's my plug.
I certainly would echo that. And I would say that unlike the Army, we guarantee you, in fact, we serve, I think, 5 hot meals a day. Plus, we've got this fantastic soup at 10 o'clock whenever you're on a ship. So it's a pretty good lifestyle that way. You get your own bunk. You're not sleeping in the woods, in the mud and everything else, wondering if you're ever going to get a hot meal again in the cold. So, you know, that's what I would argue. But then again, if you want to run through the woods with a rifle, you got to join the Army. That's what they do.
Yeah, it's so true. And, you know, Admiral, I'll also say that you guys have heads and wash spaces. And for those that don't know what that is, toilets and showers. So that's a big vote in my opinion.
Running water. Yep. Hot showers and all of the rest of the stuff. But the other thing is that you get the opportunity to work with cutting edge technology. Like, we have some of the most sophisticated sensor and computer systems in the world. And even if you don't want to work on the weapon side of things, like just the simple technology, it's the same, you know, jet engine that flies jetliners is what drives our ships forward. We've got, you know, leading edge diesel generators, incredible control systems. I mean, Canada has designed and implemented the integrated platform management systems and battle damage control systems that are used on the Queen Elizabeth class aircraft carriers in the UK. You know, that's how good our technology is. And it's an opportunity for Canadians who are really want to work on the leading edge of stuff while serving their country to have that chance.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Royal Canadian Navy has been exploring a training model with HMCS Winnipeg recently. And I guess it's also kind of a novel crewing model. I believe it's good to see, but I think the long view focus of this effort is trying to figure out what kind of crewing models you'll need for future ships, I believe. And also, I guess, for the existing ships, you know, how do you perhaps operate them with less people? So therefore, the folks that you have, you can spread out further. And correct me where I'm wrong there, Admiral, but how has that been going, that experiment through HMCS Winnipeg?
Yeah, so it's gone well enough on board Winnipeg that what we've done is we've extended it across the fleet. And the bottom line is that when we sail a ship on operations, one of our frigates, it sails with about 250 soldiers, sailors, aviators, operators on board. So it is actually representative of all of the functions, but most of those 250 are sailors. Only about 160 of those positions need really high level or very specific qualifications and training. The other 90 need generic sailor skills, generic Canadian Armed Forces sailor skills, and a whole host of other things while they learn to do the next job. And so what we're doing is we're really focused on making sure that we've got that core crew solid at around 160 to 170 people. And then the rest of the bunks on the ship are filled with people who need to get to sea, to get the experience, to learn for their next job, to demonstrate the skill sets that they require. You know, navies have always learned at sea. I mean, the classroom is fantastic. We'll teach you the theory, but the practical reality of what it's like when the ship is moving through the water, when the waves are hitting you, when the weather's not ideal, and you still got to get the job done, when you're dealing with making sure the radar is working in a difficult climate environment, you know, with potentially disruptions in the electromagnetic spectrum, how do you work through all of that stuff? The classroom only gets you so far. We learn at sea. And so we're really focusing on, as soon as we can, let's get sailors to sea. Let's get them as much quality sea time as we can. And that will accelerate our training.
Wonderful. Having had the privilege to go on Royal Canadian Navy ships. Yeah. A simulator is really good. And the simulators today are excellent, but there's no substitution for being on board for sure. So the defense policy update has recently been released. How do you interpret it from a Navy perspective?
It and the subsequent announcements at the NATO summit paint a very clear picture of a country that is determined to ensure that we can control our sovereignty and security in all three of our oceans. There is no doubting the Arctic focus of our North Strong and Free. And it's, you know, I'm excited by that because we have delivered a class of ships in the Harry DeWolf class that are designed to operate in that environment. And we're delivering capabilities that will ensure we know what's going on in our Arctic waters and that we can do something about it. There's still a lot of work to be done to get where we need to be. And ONSAF talks about the need for underwater surveillance systems and persistent and deployable sensor systems that we're working on all of those. But the other exciting thing for us is the announcement that the minister and prime minister made, the minister announcing that we're going to build up to 12 conventionally powered under ice capable submarines. And the prime minister committing that Canada will reach the 2% of GDP target by 2032, those indicate that there's a substantial investment being made in the Canadian Armed Forces. And so my job right now is to make sure that we spend that money as wisely as possible, that we get the right capability mix out there, and that we are meeting the very clear mandate the government has given us is to make sure that our North remains strong and free.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. I think many of us that follow defense were pleased to hear about the government's announcement about submarines at the NATO summit. What lessons has the Royal Canadian Navy learned from operating the Victoria class? And how do you foresee the Navy applying those lessons to the new class of Canadian patrol submarine project submarines?
So I think it's a sports cliche, but I've heard it said, and I can't remember which, I think it was a coach said this, the most important ability is availability. And that would be the number one lesson I take from the Victoria class. It doesn't matter how good the submarine is, if it can't get out of harbor, it's of no use to anyone. And so for us, this is all being driven by two things. One, we need to replace the Victoria class as quickly as we possibly can. And two, whatever that solution is, it needs to have a maintenance package that ensures an availability that's greater than what we've achieved with the Victoria class. So what are we doing to get after that? Well, the first thing is that we have committed, you know, to this is intended to be a military off-the-shelf procurement, buying a submarine that is in production. So not a design, not a concept, but something that actually exists and buying it as is. We have about 215 qualified submariners in Canada. We are not going to adapt a submarine to them. We are going to adapt them to the submarine that we buy because we are too small a force to do it any other way. And that'll be a heck of a lot faster than to try and design something that meets our requirements. Our requirements, you know, they are different from other navies, but not so unique that we can't make whatever we can buy off the marketplace right now work for Canada. The second thing is, whoever builds that submarine, we need to make sure that they build a maintenance enterprise in Canada on both coasts to sustain submarine operations. And so what we've been recommending to government is that when we pick that original equipment manufacturer who's going to build the submarine for us, that they are the ones who identify the maintenance partners in Canada, because they're going to have to transfer the intellectual property or give access to the intellectual property. They're going to have to make sure that they share their approach to everything else. They share the technology that underlies there, and they have to build the capacity to work with those boats, with those systems, to truly maintain it in Canada. And that's the value proposition for Canada. You know, 70% of the value of the submarine contract is not the acquisition, it's the in-service support here in Canada. And that is where we'll see the Canadian jobs, the Canadian technology growth, the Canadian benefits. So that's really our focus. And from my point of view, very selfishly, getting that right ensures that we get boats that can do the job that will be available to do it when we need it.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think the past certainly has made that clear. Yeah. They can't come quick enough. Do you have any rough kind of a vision of what timeline we might be looking at?
I bug my team all the time. I want them tomorrow.
Right.
So it's what we're doing right now. And so the next step in the process is to release a request for information to basically submarine manufacturers to see what's in the marketplace right now. How does it measure up against our requirements? When could it be delivered? And to inform the decision-making process about, you know, what can we get? When can we get it? And what's it going to cost? So that we make the right choice for Canada. At the end of the day, I think a big part of this is not just picking the best submarine for Canada, it's picking the best partnership for Canada. You know, there's a lot of different countries that can manufacture submarines of the type that would work for us. As long as those submarines meet our minimum requirements, and we're trying to keep those as low as possible so to allow the greatest opportunity, then it's really is like, what's the best strategic partnership that benefits all of Canada, not just the Navy? This isn't about a submarine. This is about making sure that Canada is secure in the world and that we are not having an orphan fleet. So not a fleet of submarines that we're the only ones in the world to operate, but something that has a network of support around the world, other navies that operate them, parts that we use them, and that we create a real mutually beneficial relationship between ourselves and the country that supplies the submarines, such that we both benefit from that relationship.
Right on. I'm looking forward to seeing I think we all are looking forward to seeing whatever that might be. So you mentioned the Canadian Surface Combatant and that steel has finally been cut on a production test module. That was very exciting. How did the Navy come to pick the River Class Destroyer as the name for the class?
Yeah, so we have a ship naming committee that brings together a very wide group of people, not just within the Navy, but really to try and reach into as many different perspectives as possible. So we did bring in a whole sorts of different diverse voices and perspectives, including the Indigenous community, the 2SL LGBTQI+, Francophone Canadians, you know, everyone else that reflects our heritage. There's a number of historians that are on that, a number of people who are not in the Navy who really sort of share their outside perspective. And we looked at, all of the different ways we could go and a close look at our history. And I think what I was really pleased with, because I wasn't a part of that committee, I just got to see the output of their discussions, is we landed on recognition that rivers have always connected Canada. You know, it's how we've traveled across this great land historically and how we continue to travel across this land today. When you think about it, you know, the St. Lawrence Seaway goes all the way to Thunder Bay. It reaches halfway across this country. The Fraser River on the West Coast, critically important to the economy of British Columbia. And then the Mackenzie River, which just winds its way across so much of the North. So the fact that we, you know, our first three ships will be the Fraser, the St. Laurent, and the Mackenzie is absolutely perfect from my perspective of highlighting that heritage. And there are three ships that have a very proud history in the Royal Canadian Navy. Fraser and St. Laurent were the first two to sail for convoys in the Second World War. For much of the war, period. And after the war, River-class destroyers were the heart of the Canadian fleet. And so to go back to that heritage, to me, just seems perfectly appropriate.
I think that's lovely. And I was not aware that you weren't involved in that group. So that's kind of neat. So when are you expecting the first CSC? And is there anything in your capacity to accelerate their arrival?
I wish I could accelerate it further. So we are looking, if everything goes according to plan, to cut steel on the first one in April of next year. And so the difference between the production test module and the cutting steel on the first ship is the production test module is proving Irving's readiness to build the ship, doing the things that they haven't done before in terms of steel work, armor plating, specific types of cuts and welds and fabrications that they have not done for the Arctic and offshore patrol ship. So that's all the stuff that they're proving right now, and that they can convert, you know, the design, the detailed design drawings into an actual production output so that all the process is lined up. And so that when they hit start, so to speak, that the parts delivered to the right places, cut the right way, assembled the right way, that the workers and the production material are all aligned and arriving and sequencing through the production process properly. So that's what the production test module is all about. Next year, we hope to actually start building the first one. That's a process. It's an 8,000 ton warship. So we are estimating that based on what we're seeing with allies, that we're looking at least 6 to 7 years of building before we're able to launch that ship. So that takes us early into the 2030s. This is going to be the most complex warship Canada has ever built. We'll have a radar that can see into space, missiles that can reach to the edge of space and far inland, you know, a host of incredible sensors and combat technology that has to be fully integrated, that has to work, and that has to be safe. And so to test and prove all of that, we anticipate will take about 3 years. And so when we then, and that's a ship that's that basically says, okay, this ship meets the requirements the Navy has set out. Then we have to make sure that the ship is ready to deploy. So it's not just that it's technically ready to go, but that it's tactically and from a personnel point of view that that ship's company is ready to deploy operationally. And so we're estimating that the first operational deployment of the River-class destroyer, so HMCS Fraser, will be about 2035. So we're still 10 years away from that, which is an incredibly long time. And that's just the first one. So we know the Halifax-class has to keep going, you know, until 2040. As far as what are we focused on to accelerate that as best we can, we're working with Irving to get to a place where we can deliver 9 of them by 2040. That really is the critical interim goal. Because like I said, the first one just means that one of the 4 Halifax class that deploys every year can take a break. I need to get to the place where all 4 of the Halifax class ships that we deploy every year can be relieved by Canadian surface combatants. So that means that what really matters to the Navy is not the delivery of ship one, but the operational readiness of ship 4 and ship 5. That's when the Halifax class can be retired. To get to that means we need to have 9 of them by 2040. When you work out the timeline for taking the ships through tests and trials and acceptance and delivery and all the rest of it. So believe me, if I could wave a magic wand and make it happen faster, I would. Irving has done some incredible work to make sure that their process is as streamlined as possible. And we study the master schedule every, you know, there's a high level governance meeting every 3 months where we all sit around a table and make sure that we're all aligned with the importance of this. And then finally, the other thing I'll say is that we've been making decisions to give precedence to schedule above pretty much all else, while balancing cost, obviously. And that means that we have favored systems that have already been proven, that are in service, and that have already been integrated into the core systems that will be a part of the River-class destroyer. So everything we can do to bring this along as quickly as possible is being done right now.
You have mentioned that the Navy has needed to prioritize the Halifax class over the MCDVs, you know, now that you brought up the Halifax class. Is that still the case? And what does that mean for the MCDVs?
So I think what it means is we need to get out of the old ship business as quickly as we can. And you may have seen some remarks by the minister a couple of weeks ago where he says he's waiting for me to deliver a recommendation with respect to the future of the MCDVs. When you look at that class, the reality is that they were designed to last 25 to 30 years. We're at that window. They have been absolutely fantastic. They've got a new lease on life right now with the offboard systems and technology that we've got for mine countermeasures. In fact, really proud of the fact that it's Shawinigan and I think Glace Bay that are deployed right now with the Standing NATO Maritime Countermeasures Group in Europe doing the business. That's fantastic to see. That shows that that platform can still be relevant today. But when you step back and you look at what is it, a maritime coastal defense vessel is effectively an offshore support vessel. It's the type of things that are used routinely around the world to support the offshore industry, to do work in the sort of in the littoral regions out to a couple hundred miles offshore. It is something that if we really needed to get more of them, we could do that quite quickly. They're not heavily armed. They're not designed to survive a massive conflict. MCDVs have effectively a couple machine guns and some sophisticated communications systems. We can replicate that quite quickly. We are really confident in the offboard systems that we're proving. And so we're at the point now where I get told all the time, how come you're not using more uncrewed systems, more autonomous vessels and all of the rest of it? So I think where we're looking to go is to figure out, yeah, do we need to be out of the MCDV business? We know that push came to shove in a wartime. We could probably find a replacement for them quite quickly if we really needed to have that capability back. And in the meantime, should we focus our resources on the future? Should we make sure that we are transitioning to the future fleet, that we are embracing autonomy, uncrewed systems, remotely operated things, and all sorts of other systems that can go on to vessels of opportunity that can be deployed off of vessels that are not necessarily part of the Navy fleet? Could be Government of Canada vessels in the Coast Guard or other things, or even ships that are taken up from trade, leased or operated in other ways. So that's where I'm really keen to sort of let's change our paradigm and figure out how do we deliver a capability that can be separated from the actual ship on which it's delivered in some cases.
Right. And so is there going to be a follow on to the class, like people have been talking about a Corvette type ship?
The nuance I would offer is that the MCDV replacement will not be an MCDV.
Right.
We have started some theorizing around what would a Canadian multi-mission Corvette look like. Corvette being a bit of a misnomer because I mean, it's a nod to our history. I love the fact that we were a Corvette and destroyer Navy in the Second World War in the Battle of the Atlantic, you know, really the high water mark for the Royal Canadian Navy in terms of our contribution to Canadian security and defense. And so I love the name Corvette, but what we're probably building is something that's going to be more capable than what might come to mind with a Corvette. It has to be a real warship. The driving philosophy behind whatever comes, it needs to be, what could we not quickly replicate in a time of war? Now, so if it's a civilian pattern vessel that has much of our history, you know, we had armed yachts that served in the Second World War. The fundamental design of the Corvette was a quick and nasty, as Churchill described them, was a whaling vessel that was converted to wartime service and armed quickly. I think what we need to make sure we do with the, you know, what we're notionally calling the Canadian multi-mission Corvette is figure out what's the core sort of warship systems that we need to have, the type of thing that you can't build quickly in a wartime that you need to have in advance that really genuinely meets that definition of combatant, but at the right level. And the Australians have talked about tier one and tier two combatants, with the river class destroyers being clearly a tier one combatant along like their Hunter class. And so I'm watching with interest what other navies are doing in that sort of tier two level. What are the roles and functions that we need to make sure are covered off in the current security environment? And then more importantly is, what's the right way to ensure that we're going down the right direction of uncrewed and autonomous? Or increasingly, I'm mindful of maybe optionally crewed is the right way, where the ship is normally crewed with a small crew, but that crew doesn't have to be on board if you get to high-end conflict or if you need to push the risk envelope in a different way. There's some really interesting work going on with that in the U.S. Navy and the Australian Navy. So I would say the first part of any project is always that sort of initial identification of what is it we need. And that's very much the phase of the thinking that we're at right now. And that's why we're going out to industry. We're going out to think tanks and working with others to and studying other navies to say, what are we seeing in other places as the answer to this sort of problem?
Exciting times, Admiral. I think that's wonderful that we've got that vision, or that you have that vision. And I'm excited to see what fruit that bears. So our time is up here, and I just wanted to thank you so much for joining me today here on CDR Radio. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you again, and I look forward to our next opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, Jody. It's always a great opportunity to talk to you. I love the questions, and I really appreciate the entrance from CDR in the Royal Canadian Navy.
Thank you, sir. That, my friends, was Vice Admiral Angus Topshe, the commander of the Royal Canadian Navy. Thanks, everyone, for joining me today on CDR Radio, and I hope you'll tune in for our next great guest.
Tune in next time for another Canadian Defense Focus podcast from CDR Radio.